From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, four dead and hundreds missing. We're in South Korea as the search for survivors from yesterday's ferry disaster continues.
There were 320 students on a class trip that were on this boat when it went down. And the families from the town that these kids were from, of course, are devastated.
Also today, the New York Police Department drops its policy of eavesdropping on Muslim residents. The United Kingdom prosecutes the first case of female genital mutilation. And billionaire former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg takes on America's pro-gun lobby.
This is simply making sure that people that everybody agrees should not be allowed to buy a gun, criminals, minors, and people with psychiatric problems, make sure they can't buy guns.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. At least four people are dead and hundreds missing after a ferry capsized and sank off the coast of South Korea. Officials say nearly 300 passengers, many of them teenagers, are still missing. A U.S. Navy ship and helicopters have bolstered ongoing rescue efforts. The ferry was en route from the port of Incheon in the southern resort island of Jeju, carrying mainly school students. Passengers report hearing a loud noise before the ship began to sink. Choi Hee-sok from the Korean Herald says there was initial confusion about how many people had been rescued.
The Ministry of Security and Public Administration initially said that 386 also had been rescued, but it turns out that they added up the wrong numbers wrong, because the rescue efforts are being carried out by several different organizations, and they just made a mistake.
In eastern Ukraine, Kiev's so-called anti-terrorism operation against pro-Moscow activists has not gone smoothly, as the protesters seized six Ukrainian armored vehicles. This, according to Kiev's defense ministry. NATO is launching military reinforcements in reaction to the increased activity of the pro-Russian militia. Additional aircraft, ships, and ground support are being deployed to the Baltic Sea and eastern Mediterranean, as NATO staff seek to ensure the readiness of Russian border countries like Latvia, Lithuania, and Romania. The package of defense measures was announced ahead of political talks in Geneva, Switzerland on Thursday between the foreign ministers of the U.S., Russia, Ukraine, and the EU to reduce tension in the region. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen called on Russia to pull its more than 30,000 troops from Europe's western borders.
We call on Russia to be part of the solution to stop destabilizing Ukraine, pull back its troops from the borders.
Muslim groups and civil liberties advocates have praised the New York Police Department's decision to disband a controversial post-9/11 unit that monitored Muslims. The NYPD's demographics unit tracked Muslims going about their daily lives as part of an effort to detect terrorism threats. Rebecca Bowring has more from New York.
The demographics unit was developed with the CIA's help following the 9/11 attacks. It put together databases on where Muslims lived, shopped, worked and prayed, monitored Muslim-owned businesses and used plainclothes officers to eavesdrop on people in mosques. Community activists had accused the NYPD of abusing civil rights. The department has now confirmed the unit's personnel have been reassigned to other duties. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio says the move is a critical step in easing tensions between police and the communities they serve.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Unemployment levels in the UK have fallen by 77,000 to a five-year low. Figures taken between December and February show 2.24 million people are now out of work, a number which could now trigger an interest rate hike. The former mayor of New York City has announced plans to build an organization he hopes will challenge the National Rifle Association, a powerful lobbying group for gun owners' rights. Michael Bloomberg says he will spend $50 million U.S. dollars this year in an attempt to change the national conversation on this highly contentious issue. From New York, Iris Spitzer reports.
Bloomberg says anti-gun advocates can learn from the strong-arm tactics of the NRA, who have been able to effectively pressure politicians for years who challenge the country's gun-friendly laws. The new network, which combines several other groups he currently funds under one umbrella, will be called Every Town for Gun Safety. However, even in his announcement of the plan, the billionaire former mayor of America's largest city was careful not to alienate gun owners.
Nobody's going to take anybody's gun away. Nobody's going to keep you from hunting or target practice or protecting yourself.
And police have charged a man after a security scare on the day the U.S. city of Boston marked the one-year anniversary of the Marathon bombings. After the memorial events on Tuesday evening, police evacuated the same area where the bombs went off last year and carried out controlled explosions on two bags found there. Nick Harper reports from Boston.
25-year-old Kevin Edson has been charged with six crimes, including possession of a hoax explosive device. He was stopped by officers on Tuesday evening as he walked barefoot down Ballston Street, where the two bombs exploded last April. He was wearing all black, a veil covered his face, and he was shouting. In his bag was a rice cooker, similar to the pressure cookers that contained the homemade bombs that killed three people at last year's marathon.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. At least four people are dead and hundreds missing after a ferry capsized off the coast of South Korea. Officials say nearly 300 passengers, many of them teenagers attending a school field trip, are still missing. Officials say it's not clear what caused the vessel to capsize. A US Navy ship and helicopters have now joined the search and rescue mission. Seoul-based journalist Jason Strother says early reports gave conflicting accounts of the scale of the disaster.
I think especially for the parents of the students who were on this ferry, they're the most confused. It's really been in flux, the numbers going back and forth. The South Korean Coast Guard saying that pretty much everyone had been rescued at first, and then the turnaround saying close to 300 are missing. And the number still stands in the hundreds, and there's a fear that many of them are trapped inside of the ship now that is pretty much completely submerged. Many of those missing would be undoubtedly be some from the high school. Around 320 high school students were on that boat when it sank.
Why so many high school students on this particular journey? Where was it traveling to and from?
The high school students were on a class trip. They were going to Jeju, which is far off the South Korean southern coast. It's not only a vacation spot, but it also has historical significance. So this was a school trip. They were there with their teachers. They had still some time left to go before they reached Jeju when the boat capsized.
And what was the initial response of the South Korean authorities when they first heard news that this boat was in trouble?
The South Korean Coast Guard was really quick to move. It only took about an hour after the distress call was first signaled for the Coast Guard to dispatch helicopters and to get ships out there. The Navy joined in. The Coast Guard and the Naval Forces are completely equipped to handle this sort of situation. Travel by ferry boat is very common in South Korea, although this is the first time that I have in my memory living here of hearing of such a grand scale disaster like this.
Well, they're talking about it perhaps being the worst in the country's history.
This very well could be the worst maritime disaster in South Korea's history.
Is there any suggestion of what might have happened to cause this boat to list and then subsequently begin to sink?
It's still very unclear what caused this boat to sink. Some of the passengers that made it off safely say that they heard a loud bang before the boat started to sink. So there was some speculation that it perhaps run aground, hit a reef, hit a rock. Although now the Coast Guard officials, other people with knowledge of those waters say that it's unlikely that there's any reefs there. So it's really unclear what happened.
This is FSN Reports. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Geneva for more talks on the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. Mr. Kerry is expected to once again urge Moscow to withdraw troops from the border with eastern Ukraine and reiterate calls for pro-Russian supporters in the region to stand down and disarm. Ahead of Thursday's meeting, NATO announced it was beefing up its military presence in eastern Europe in response to Russia's actions. The US and allies have imposed economic sanctions against Russia after Moscow's annexation of Crimea, and additional sanctions have been threatened. For more details on the latest developments, I spoke to FSN FSN's Jack Parrock in Brussels.
The NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says that they're now going to step up their military operations and capabilities on the eastern border with Russia from Ukraine, the eastern border of the alliance. He said NATO will protect every ally and defend against any threat against our fundamental security. Now, he has stressed that this move is designed to be a deterrent rather than any actual preparation for any conflict. And what they seem to be doing, what's going to be involved, is that aircraft will fly more over the Baltic regions, and that they're going to deploy Allied ships into the Baltic Sea and to the Eastern Mediterranean as required. He says that they want to enhance their preparedness, training and exercises. Now, Russia has 40,000 troops drawn along that eastern Ukrainian border, so there very much is a line being drawn. This all comes as it's alleged that Russia has issued shoot-to-kill orders against Ukrainian soldiers. So the situation certainly does seem to be escalating and not de-escalating, as the Western sides have been hoping.
And how will Russia react to this NATO announcement? And do we know what steps the alliance wants to see Moscow take next?
So since this all began, NATO, along with the US and the EU, have been pushing for Moscow to withdraw that big bulk of troops from the eastern Ukrainian border. Now, it was announced by the Russians that some had been, but it was something like 600, which clearly, when it was around 40,000 there, wasn't deemed to be very much. Now, NATO, along with the US and the EU, are continuing to try to push for a de-escalation of this crisis in Ukraine. They want it politically and diplomatically resolved. But what's happened today with this announcement of military operation is a big step. It's very hard to tell how Russia will react. This is really the first talk of military engagement from a Western point of view, of active military involvement anyway. There was the idea of some kind of common shared defence mission from the EU mooted earlier this week when the foreign affairs ministers met in Luxembourg, but that was very much a kind of vague idea. So this really shows that NATO doesn't feel that sanctions have had the desired effect. Their suspension of missions with Russia, which is what they've done so far, NATO as an alliance, clearly didn't have the desired effect. So now they seem to be going one step further.
This NATO move, this comes ahead of Thursday's meeting in Geneva. We know John Kerry is already there. What can you tell us about that?
So the pressure really does seem to be piling on Russia ahead of that meeting that you just mentioned in Geneva, between the US, Russia, Ukraine and the EU Thursday. All four sides are coming together, and it's mainly been pushed from a US point of view. And they're saying that they want to try and find a four-way solution. But clearly, with the interim Ukrainian government having the backing of the EU and the US, it's very much going to be a kind of three-on-one. Now, the EU has come out today and said that they are pushing for stage three of sanctions. They're very much ready and geared up to put on broad economic sanctions, things like arms embargoes, to really hurt Russia, which has a struggling economy. But so far, the sanctions list of the individuals that was drawn up doesn't seem to have had much of an effect. So this is probably why NATO's looking at more military options. Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, in the run-up to this meeting has been defiant. He's accused some of his Western counterparts of being liars. So there really doesn't seem to be too much positivity surrounding what results are actually going to manage to come out of this meeting in Geneva.
Jack Parrock in Brussels. Now, billionaire former New York mayor Michael Bloomberg is setting up a new organisation to take on America's pro-gun lobby.
This is simply making sure that people that everybody agrees should not be allowed to buy a gun, criminals, minors and people with psychiatric problems, make sure they can't buy guns.
Talking to NBC's Today Show, he said he'd spend $50 million this year alone on a campaign to counter the National Rifle Association. The new group is called Every Town for Gun Safety and will be a grassroots campaign trying to mobilise individuals who want further gun control. John Donoghue is a professor at Stanford Law School and spoke to Adam Bairn about Mr. Bloomberg's plans and started by giving his reaction to the announcement.
Well, it's sort of an amazing initiative. It shows that he was, you know, not simply interested in this as a politician, but also has a strong interest in his own personal life and is willing to put a fairly substantial amount of his own resources just for a single year's initiative. So it's pretty impressive.
And $50 million does sound like a lot of money. Is it actually enough to get done what he wants to do?
It's obviously a huge battle that he's trying to wage, and there are a lot of questions about what should be done and what can be done, and it's not always clear. I think everybody thought after the tragic shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, that one would see a federal comprehensive universal background check law put into place. And despite overwhelming support for that, the power of the gun lobby was great enough to stop that. So that's the dynamic that they will be working against.
The umbrella group, which former Mayor Bloomberg is starting, will be called Every Town for Gun Safety. And if you go on the website, the first sort of opening video you see is, of course, the little girl playing in the house, discovers an unsecured handgun. The implication is that she has actually shot herself with it. They say 2 million children live in homes with unsecured guns. And they're going for the grassroots, looking to mobilise individual voters, particularly mothers who might be concerned about this. Is that the right tactic?
It is a potentially valuable approach because it's clearly a problem that there are too many guns in this country that are unsecured and available for not only children to grab them, but also for burglars to walk off with them and do much criminal mischief. So focusing on this, I think, is something that may be able to capture the attention of people. I mean, I think almost everyone in the country feels that we do have a problem of too much gun violence, but it's something that has not galvanized the interest of those in favor of taking additional steps to reduce that problem, as opposed, of course, to the NRA, which has a body of very strongly engaged supporters.
You mentioned the NRA, the National Rifle Association, and their experience in these matters and campaigning. Former Mayor Bloomberg's group are going to be pretty new at this. How do you think they'll stack up against the NRA?
Well, of course, they won't have the big backing that the NRA gets from the gun manufacturers, but at least Bloomberg has given them a small start in that direction compared to the others. But one thing that Bloomberg has going for him is that probably about 90% of Americans support some of his initiatives. So even though the support is not nearly as intense as the NRA can muster for their small minority, 90% still matters, at least somewhat, in a democracy.
Public opinion is perhaps in Mr. Bloomberg's favor, but he's already tried this before, particularly in Congress, and nothing really has happened. So what's different this time?
It does seem to me that universal background checks is so uncontroversial among most Americans that seems to be something that we really should be able to get done. You know, now we're in a position to do that, and I think the last step needs to be taken and should be taken.
How worried are you about what the NRA might say about this? I mean, so far today, they've really not said anything. They don't seem to be losing sleep over it at all.
Well, they've been in the driver's seat for some time now, and so they're very confident. You know, they know they're always one day away from the next catastrophe, and these mass shootings come at relatively steady paces of about one every 3 months. And so they know that they're always somewhat vulnerable. On the other hand, you know, it'll be hard to top the Newtown killing in terms of damaging the public spirit, because that was a simply horrific event.
John Donoghue, professor at Stanford Law School, was speaking to FSN's Adam Byrne. And we stay in New York, where following an expose by Associated Press and two federal lawsuits, the city's police department announced this week that it's ending its policy of eavesdropping on Muslim residents in mosques, businesses and neighbourhoods in New York and New Jersey. Not only did the programme yield not one terrorism investigation, the FBI said it hurt US national security by sowing distrust for law enforcement. For more, our reporter Alice Olstein spoke to Ryan Mahoney, the president of New York's Council on American Islamic Relations, about the significance of the announcement and efforts to protect privacy and freedom of association going forward.
It's definitely good news. However, we have to be vigilant, because what we really need is an end to the policy of mass surveillance against any community based on their skin color and their religious beliefs or ethnic background.
Is that concern coming out of the fact that the name of the program was already changed once and was previously secret?
Yes, absolutely. There's also another unit that's still around called the Terrorist Interdiction Unit. And this unit is the one that had designated entire mosques as terrorist organizations last year. There have been no arrests, and that was a really ugly claim that was made against the Muslim community. So we need to see a broad policy change.
And can you tell us what the impact has been on the Muslim community in the New York area of this program?
The harms of it are very broad. Just the existence of such a program that surveils the Muslim community based on our faith creates the impression that this surveillance needs to happen and that Muslims should be feared or there should be uncertainty about the community. It also stifles free speech. So if you have a particular political viewpoint, you might not express it in certain public forums or even private meetings and cafes and things like that, because you never know if someone's going to overhear it, take it out of context, and create a file on you. We know that countless innocent people now have police files created on them. We'd like to know who those people are. We'd like for those people to have the files, and we'd like those files to be destroyed. It's also created a climate of distrust in the Muslim community, because you really don't know if you're talking to someone, you know, maybe they're a spy, maybe they're going to try to use some kind of information against you. Even nonprofit groups that were infiltrated by spies, and it was became, you know, widespread knowledge. These groups were ejected from places where they would do fundraising. Mosques have lost attendees. They've lost funding. So the harms are very widespread.
As a legal group, what aspects of this program do you see as most legally or constitutionally questionable?
It's one thing and totally legitimate to follow up on a criminal lead. If someone is to call the police and assert that an individual or a place, that there's a crime taking place, the NYPD should follow up on that. What makes this unconstitutional is the NYPD or no law group should engage in mass surveillance only on the basis of religion, ethnic background, skin color, and it needed to end.
And are there particular legal concerns about surveillance within houses of worship?
Yes, but it's not limited to houses of worship. Religious leaders need to do their work, and they need to be able to talk about the religion. They need to be able to administer social services. They need to educate people, and they're hampered by the fear that they're being surveilled. But it's not limited to religious centers. Really, student groups spying on, you know, teenagers is another dimension of this that's really egregious.
So going forward, there's a lot of hopes and concerns about the new mayor of New York City. What do you think he can do to make a difference and connect better with different communities?
So I think this mayor is known to be someone who is partial to listening to communities, to addressing community concerns. I think he needs to do that, but we have to see policy changes. Under the previous administration, as we had mentioned, there had been some superficial changes. All these are welcome signs, but really we need policy changes.
There are still lawsuits ongoing.
These cases are looking for an end to the policy as well as specific damages in cases where individuals or organizations have been financially harmed by this policy.
And those are still ongoing. Where are those at?
Yeah, those cases are still ongoing. Legal cases certainly take time to come to a conclusion, so they're ongoing at this time.
Alice Olstein speaking to Ryan Mahoney, president of New York's Council on American-Islamic Relations. Now, two men will be tried in the United Kingdom in the country's first prosecution for female genital mutilation. The British government sees it as a step in the right direction after being compared unfavourably to other countries like France, where there have been over 100 successful prosecutions. The traditional and often painful practice is thought to affect over 125 million girls and women worldwide, as our UK correspondent Natalie Powell reports.
Thousands of girls in the UK are at risk of becoming victims of FGM, according to campaigners. Practicing female genital mutilation has been a crime in Britain since 1985, as Jackie Hunt, the London Office Director of Equality Now, an international women's rights campaign group, explains.
FGM is illegal in this country, and it's also illegal to take a girl abroad to practice FGM. So in either of those circumstances, people who have been involved in that crime can be prosecuted. It's just very difficult, especially if you take someone abroad, to find out who did it.
The most up-to-date statistics on the subject were taken 10 years ago and show that 66,000 women in Britain are thought to be affected by FGM. A figure that Equality Now says today could be even higher. The organisation is currently working on compiling new statistics, and globally this number is much greater. Children's rights organisation Plan UK works with communities across Africa to try to tackle the issue of FGM. Geneva is 17 and from Sierra Leone. Her name has been changed to protect her identity. Her society practices FGM as an initiation ritual, and although she doesn't want to be initiated, she faces massive amounts of family pressure. Geneva says the main thing that she hates is the cutting, and that it's all about shedding blood, and she doesn't like it. But campaign groups in the UK say global changes are afoot. Colin Walker, the campaigns manager at Plan UK, believes there's now a move away from seeing the practice as a cultural tradition, with more and more people recognising it as an abuse crime.
It's culturally sensitive and that therefore there's a reluctance to get involved with it. However, we're seeing that changing. The real global efforts to tackle FGM are being driven by African countries, by African communities, but also by African diasporas within the UK.
And it's hoped that the first UK prosecution at Westminster Magistrates Court will help highlight the issue even further. Legislation banning the practices associated with FGM has existed in the UK for almost 30 years, but this is the first time that a case has gone to court. The British government has received a fair amount of criticism about that fact, but says it's stepping up its response to the crime. Campaigners, however, say that prosecution is only part of it. They want to see more prevention measures to stop girls getting hurt in the future. Natalie Powell, London.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Thursday, we'll be following the Ukraine crisis as top US and Russian ministers meet in Geneva. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the bulletin desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.